This Week in Retronauts.
Ha! 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 Ha!
Hey everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I think this is episode like 373, but I could be wrong. Don't quote me on that. It's an episode far in the future because we are talking about the Final Fantasy that's far in the future, but also a thousand years in the past. It's really convoluted. Don't ask me to explain it. It's Final Fantasy X. Did I just say I'm Jeremy Parrish? I can't remember, you know, the whole Pyrefy thing. I'm fading into the past. Anyway, I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this continues our ongoing series of episodes about the Final Fantasy core games and spinoffs, which we started like 5 years ago. So we're kind of trucking along at about two per year, and we are up to the double digits, although this is actually a Final Fantasy whose title is written with a single digit because it's Roman numerals, and it's just an X, no VII. However they do that. Anyway, it's Final Fantasy X. And with me, once again, to talk about old Final Fantasy games. This one's 20 years old now, by the way. Who do we have here out in San Francisco? Actually, everyone's in San Francisco.
I'm not in San Francisco.
Oh, no. Where
I say
you?
As I cross my arms, it's me, Bob Mackey. I'm a Blitzball doping scandal victim, and I will be exonerated one day.
All right, let's see. We've got B. Whose name starts with a C? I can do this alphabetical thing because the names are right there in front of me on the Hangouts.
That's probably me, Chris Kohler. I provide drugs to Blitzball players.
Oh, damn.
And finally, whose name does not start with a C? It's tricky. It starts with a K.
It's Cap Bailey, Luka Goa Striker, which makes me sad because everybody made Blitzball jokes. I was hoping that I'd be the only one because I'm the sports fan here.
Right, you're the sports fan. I will tell you that the Blitzball part of this game is the part that I never touch. So I'm on brand. I am Jeremy Parrish. Once again, I am ready to ride the shoe puff. And we are talking about Final Fantasy. Like I said, we've gone through the NES era, the Super NES era, and then into the PlayStation era. Now we have gone beyond PS1. We are at PS2. And with the advent of this new exciting video game technology, the Final Fantasy series really kind of had a clean break from the past. I don't know if we need to recap what we've talked about in the past, but, you know, I would say that prior to Final Fantasy X, the Final Fantasy games kind of existed in triads, you know, trios. Like the Famicom games were all kind of a common piece. The Super NES games all had a very similar feel to them. The PlayStation 1 games all had a similar feel to them. You know, not necessarily in terms of all the specific mechanics or how the stories were played out, but in terms of the overall look and the tech and just a general kind of sense of how things functioned. But with Final Fantasy X, Square really, like, they were changing things up a lot. So I guess my question to all of you is, what were your first thoughts about Final Fantasy X when you first read about this game or saw videos of it or played it, however you first encountered it? I'm assuming at this point all of us were kind of following the series, mm-hmm. you know, on a regular basis because it was a kind of a known quantity in the U.S. and was a big game. You know, it was. I even saw commercials for this game during football. I was like, they're advertising Final Fantasy during NFL. What is happening? I feel like I've lost touch with reality.
I moved to Japan for the first time in October of 2000, and the PlayStation 2 I think was just coming out in the US, but like by the time that I moved it wasn't out in the US. So I got to Japan, bought a PS2. Had very little to do with that PS2 for a while, because the, you know, lineup of launch games was not really that appealing, and they were, you know, quite expensive. And then the Bouncer came out, and the less said about that, the better. but that was clearly sort of the test of the tech, right, for Final Fantasy II. And then I played that, and then an hour later I was done with that, and then it was another sort of long wait of, like, I don't really have much of anything to do with the PS2 until... What was the? I forget the actual date that it came out, but it was the summer of 2001, right? It was like June 2001, that it came out in Japan, and I bought, you know, obviously went out the morning that Final Fantasy X came out, bought it, went back to my dorm room and just marathoned it until the wee hours of the morning, and then slept and then got up and did it again. Just plowing my way through it, you know, really having a great time. But so much of that was A, the allure of a new Final Fantasy game is out, and B, you have to understand, like, at the time, the graphics were this combination of the technology of the PlayStation 2 was just this. I mean, it really was kind of a quantum leap over the PlayStation 1, because just the leap in terms of realism, the combination of more polygons, nicer textures, it made it look, as funny as this sounds today, like almost realistic. And the beauty, you know, of Square's graphic design really meshed, you know, to create something that just did not look like other video games at the time. It's just one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen on a video game screen, running, by the way, on my state-of-the-art, you know, 12-inch CRT TV, yeah, that I had in my dorm room at the time. Yeah. But after that, I never played it again.
Yeah, cool. Kat, what about you?
I remember seeing the first trailer in probably 1999, 2000, thereabouts, because I remember that when it was revealed right on top of, I think, Final Fantasy 11 and 12 as well.
And 11.
Yeah. Okay. So there was a big event probably in early 2000, and I downloaded the video of Yuna doing the little twirling dance, and that was our first real glimpse of Final Fantasy on PS2, and thinking, wow, this looks incredible, and it'll be out next year. That's really great, except I didn't own a PlayStation 2. I eventually got a PlayStation 2. I borrowed a PlayStation 2 from my friend over Christmas break in Christmas of 2002 and played through Final Fantasy X over the holiday. Ended up really, really, really enjoying it. Got completely hooked on Blitzball and all of that. And then a few years later, when I picked up my PS2 in 2005, I played through it again. And I remember thinking at the time that I was not that big into Tidus, but I was really a big fan of Riku and the Albed and all of that stuff. I had no idea what the heck was going on with Zanrigan. It was this big convoluted story, and I didn't know what to do with voice acting in Final Fantasy, and honestly, I still don't.
Yeah, so Bob, we'll come back to you in a minute, but Kat, you brought up something that I think is really important to discuss, which is the Square Millennium event in January 2000, which was this big hoo-hurrah in Tokyo. And, you know, basically Square said, we are journeying into the future now. And so during that event, they announced Final Fantasy XI, which shipped just a few months later. They hadn't really... You know, there had been like leaks and stuff through the Gaming Intelligence Agency, and people had seen, you know, had some idea that there was something in the works, but we hadn't actually seen the game, if I'm remembering correctly. And they were like, yeah, here's Final Fantasy IX coming for PlayStation in very, very short amount of time. And then also, there's going to be Final Fantasy X, which is going to be on PlayStation 2, and everything's going to be real time. And they showed basically a little clip of Tidus, but with black hair, running around in a field, and it was definitely real time 3D. So obviously, big jump from Final Fantasy IX, and also Final Fantasy XI. You've been begging for more Final Fantasies. Well, here we're going to give you one, and this one is exactly what you don't want. It's an online MMO. Please enjoy. And then a couple of months later, very shortly after that, they announced Final Fantasy XII, which was going to be directed by the Final Fantasy Tactics guy. They had this whole pile of Final Fantasy stuff. And the interesting thing is that none of these were being helmed by Hironobu Sakaguchi. He was very busy over in Hawaii making Final Fantasy The Spirits Within and getting fired. And, you know, basically, this was a brave new frontier for Final Fantasy. And you looked at these three, well, you know, looking beyond the PlayStation game, looking to the PS2 stuff, and I guess PC with Final Fantasy XI, and these games didn't really have that much in common. In fact, they all turned out to play radically differently. They all had very different kind of art styles and approaches to everything. This was really the end of Final Fantasy as this cohesive thing that you could go to and say, well, I pretty much know what I'm getting into. There's going to be some weird story stuff. I'm going to have to figure out the character mechanics and everything. Maybe the battle system will be a little different, but I'm pretty sure I know what this is about. And Final Fantasy X, you know, starting with that game, they basically just swept all that stuff off the table and said, nope, Final Fantasy now is basically a name. Mm-hmm. It is a brand, and we're going to do all kinds of wild stuff with it. Some of it you're going to like, and some of it you're going to hate. Please look forward to all of this. There's so much coming.
It's anyway. Kind of not super well known, but I think in the Ultimania, they said that Final Fantasy X didn't even start as a Final Fantasy. It started as a different game and then eventually became Final Fantasy X.
Really? That's interesting, because that was also, wasn't that the case for Final Fantasy IX? It was going to be some other game, and then they were like, oh, this should be...
That's true.
This should be Final Fantasy IX, not some other game.
It's a somewhat common thing for Square, I think, is just be like, why don't we just make it a Final Fantasy? And then it becomes
we sink a lot of money into this. Maybe we should slap the Final Fantasy name onto it so we can make that money back.
Yep.
All right. And Bob, what about you? What were your first impressions of FF10?
Listen to my story. Here it comes. I was in games retail at the time, and this was going to be a January of 2002 release, but it got pushed back to be a holiday release. And we were all very excited about that. And I remember, of course, it was a Final Fantasy, and I was going to play it because I was a Final Fantasy fan. But this game gave me an existential crisis because I, Bob Mackey, a Final Fantasy super fan, did not like a Final Fantasy game. And at the time, it really felt like that section of Kiki's Delivery Service in which Kiki can't like do anything and Gigi stops talking to her and all the magic is gone. And I was just questioning my lifestyle and do I even like video games anymore? Have I outgrown RPGs? Have I outgrown Final Fantasy and maybe even video games? And it turns out I keep trying to play this game. And for about a decade, I did not like core Final Fantasy games, and it really, just looking at the people who made them and having been doing Retronauts for a decade, I figured out I just don't like the people who make this game and the things that they do. People like Nojima, Nomura, Toriyama, and folks like that. I don't like the Kingdom Heartsification of Final Fantasy, even though this predates Kingdom Hearts, but you know what I mean. But there's just something about this game and the things they make I can't jive with, and Final Fantasy 14 and 15 was really when I started liking Final Fantasy games again.
Well, in fairness, this game, it does predate Kingdom Hearts, but Kingdom Hearts was basically built on this game.
Oh, yeah.
This Final Fantasy X, you know, in terms of tech and concepts, was basically like, okay, here's our proving ground. Now we're going to get some Goofy in there.
I like more Goofy in this game. but I think...
Is that what you named Tidus?
You can rename him. That's why no one can say his name.
One of the weird things about this game is that it's kind of the last Final Fantasy where you can name, I think it is the last Final Fantasy core game, where you can name the main character, and they weren't sure how to reconcile that with the voice acting. So everyone just refers to him as like you, or they just kind of like gesture at him. They never actually say Tidus's name out loud because you can name him Goofy or Jeremy or, you know, whatever you want. And you can name him Bite Me. And no one's going to say that out loud because they didn't have the technology to have every voice actor read like every possible phoneme out and combine that into, a name that would be generated in real time. So everyone's just like, hey, guy, why don't we go save the universe? You know, that kind of thing. It's very awkward. And once you notice it, you cannot stop noticing it. It stands out when I think about it, it does kind of tie into the whole, you know, the whole like sixth sense element of the story, which is that Tidus doesn't actually really exist. So, you know, the fact that no one ever actually gives him a name, no one refers to him by name, actually kind of works. But I feel like that's probably an unintended side effect. That was not a deliberate creative choice.
I have two small things to add. Number one, this is Nomura mad with power. It's the most asymmetrical clothing. It's the most belts. It's the most zippers. Like this in Kingdom Hearts, they would eventually rein him in. But this is him just going nuts. And also...
Lulu is absolutely peak Nomura. She's got the... a dress made entirely of belts, but they didn't have enough belts to cover her breasts. So you get bosomy, belty, goth lady, and that is just like I guess it's a bit darker than he normally works. I guess he would move more in that direction with Kingdom Hearts, but otherwise it is like peak Nomura.
Yeah, I guess you don't know what you got till it's gone, because in Final Fantasy 15, a game I love, all those designs are so boring and I kind of want the belts back. But another thing I wanted to bring up was you never hear Tidus's name in the game. And for months I was reading coverage of this game, and in my mind I'm like, yeah, it's a watery game, island settings, right, of course, right, it's Tidus. Yep. And then we get a tape into the game store, you know, one of those tapes that has a bunch of trailers on it, and the first thing the announcer says is, "You are Tidus." And I went, no, that can't be true. But then I guess that is the accepted pronunciation of Tidus is Tidus.
Except in Japan where it's Tita.
Tita, that's right.
But it's still spelled T-I-D-U-S. So figure that out, Peak Nomura.
You know, so U-S is the Latin masculine ending and A is the Latin feminine ending. So it's just, you know, transcendent. It is beyond gender. It's a very progressive kind of Final Fantasy. But yeah, my own first experience with this game obviously was, you know, since I was working and kind of collaborating with Gaming Intelligence Agency and just was entirely too online at that point, I saw those first little thumbnail videos and was like, wow, they're making a whole lot of Final Fantasy games all at once. That's nuts. But, you know, it's kind of neat. There's this tiny little like thumbnail sized video of a guy running around in a field. I guess that's okay. His outfit looks kind of weird, but I guess I'm used to that at this point. But when the game finally came out, and you know, for a while leading up to its release in the US, it was pretty much inescapable. Like, it was on the cover of magazines, and I think this was the one where James Milkey had Yoshitaka Amano paint like 20 different covers for EGM. And I guess he just did like an alternate cover, but there was an Amano painted cover for EGM. So it was just like front of mind. It was inescapable and pervasive, but they actually pushed the release of this game forward by several weeks, which caused a lot of trouble for the localization team, as Bob recounted in a story he posted on US Gamer a few years back. But this happened to come out right like the day after. No, I guess right around the same time I got back from my very first vacation, like my very first trip to Japan. So I got back from Japan, was just crazy jet lagged. I was not working at the time. I was crashing with my parents until I could find work, and they were out of town. So basically there was a week where I was by myself, jet lagged in a house with nothing to do except play this game. And I pretty much just freebased this game and would play it until like 5 a.m., and then fall asleep and then wake up and just jump back into the game. It's the most like unemployed nerd that I've ever been in my entire existence. But I really just mainlined this game. And by the end of it, I was, you know, a friend of mine came over and was like, I need to get you out of the house. Like right after I beat it, he was like, you need to go outside, interact with people, go eat some food, you know, let's go. But you know, it was very intense. And, definitely the most like hardcore I've ever fallen into a Final Fantasy game. And, you know, for all that, I haven't really felt the need to revisit it aside from tackling the HD remaster, which came out on Vita and I can't remember what other platforms. I did play
everything,
a fair amount of that. Basically at this point, I did play, you know, a fair bit of it to be able to review it and say like, hey, the tech holds up. The story is, you know, it's wow, it's every bit as linear as Final Fantasy 13. Like they had it there all along. But, you know, it still has stuck with me a lot just from that one experience, because that was basically the sum of my existence for a week.
Jeremy, we were in the same boat because I was also unemployed at that time, just hanging out at home in my parents' house. And I wasn't in the best place at the time. So I also pretty much mainlined Final Fantasy X. So it was a comfort at that time.
It was good for those of us who did not really exist in the world, much like Tidus. we could just, you know, enjoy our life blitzballing or whatever.
I went back and I looked, and I actually, I reviewed this game for On America magazine at the time, and I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but I still have the Word document And as it turns out, yes, my impressions at the time, and this is like before it even released in the US, was, wow, this is incredible. This is like a film or a cartoon that you can play. I mean, the graphics and the presentation are so amazing, but boy, it's really linear. There's like no side quests to speak of. There's no world map. You just go, through the game. Not in the sense that Final Fantasy 13 was linear, because I mean, that game was literally like a straight line that you ran down. Whereas, you know, Final Fantasy 10, yeah, you had to go to this next area of the map, but you could do some exploration. You could do some optional things. Like I was playing the HD remaster on Switch, and there's that part in the very beginning where you're in the forest and there's an Ochu enemy, and I think you don't have to fight it. I think you can just run. They tell you like, oh, don't mess with this guy. But I'm like, oh, I'll just fight him. But you fight him and you can get bonuses versus just like avoiding him. So there's some elements of choice. But even at the time, even with, you know, just being blown away by everything, it was like, this game is kind of linear.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, it still has plenty of side quests, and it opens up once you get the airship. The thing that just kind of irked me at the time was that it didn't have an overworld map, and I thought, well, I just want to see what an overworld map would look like on the PlayStation 2. What I didn't realize was that the overworld map as a thing was kind of dead. Mm-hmm. And that still makes me sad to this day.
Yeah, you know, you say that the game opened up once you get the airship, but what I remember about that is also being disappointed by the lack of the world map, but also the fact that once you get the airship, like, you can travel in different places around the world, but it's always just kind of like a different point along the line. Like, this is the story of Yuna's pilgrimage from the town where you start out to all the different temples around the world to finally fight Sin, and it is like a linear journey. I mean, you are kind of going down her path, and that's a very literal thing. And, you know, I think it's okay, but it's also, you know, kind of a reflection of the constraints of the technology, because even though this game was visually just, mind-blowing at the time, it was so much nicer looking than anything we had played on a home system before that. So much work was put into the environments. Prior to this, Final Fantasy had existed as, you know, on PlayStation 1 as 3D polygon characters on bitmap world maps, or, you know, backgrounds. So you were moving around spaces that were designed to look like they had dimensionality, and your characters would scale appropriately depending on how that specific static screen had been designed. So there was a great illusion, but this was the first Final Fantasy that actually put you in a world that was built entirely of polygons, and there were no static backgrounds.
Yeah.
But actually, all the backgrounds were kind of static.
Yeah.
You had, you know, a very sort of on-rails camera system. There weren't a lot of places where you could actually move the camera freely through three dimensions. I mean, that wouldn't really come until, I guess, FF11, but, you know, for the single-player games, until FF12. But with the Final Fantasy X engine, it really was kind of built around that paradigm of the PS1 static background style, the pre-rendered backgrounds like Resident Evil and, of course, the Final Fantasy games or Fear Effect or whatever. It's just that instead of those being pre-rendered, photoshopped bitmaps, they were instead generated in real time. But, you know, they were only designed to be seen from one side, from one angle. It was still very much diorama video gaming.
Definitely, and yeah. I think that's what bothered me also at the time, because I was ready for everything to, you know, just be rendered in polygons. I wanted everything to be free of the pre-established camera angle. But this game kind of feels like a very, very pretty PlayStation 1 game, because all of the visual sense of it is still defined by, we are the directors, we will show you what we want to show you.
Yeah, and I suppose if your gaming diet had consisted entirely of mainline Final Fantasy games to that point, you'd be like, whoa, this is an amazing step forward. I can't believe, like, you know, I'm in 3D. But, you know, even Square had published quite a few PS1 games that had true 3D environments. You had Vagrant Story, you had Threads of Fate, Brave Fencer Musashi, going back all the way to before Final Fantasy VIII. And, you know, some of those were static, some of those were, you know, fully rotatable, existing in, you know, all axes 3D. And so, yeah, I do feel like there was kind of a letdown. But at the same time, it was so much prettier than anything that had come before. Like the sort of overall vibe of the game is very tropical. It was kind of inspired by Okinawan culture and the sort of tropical vibe. You know, Sakaguchi was off in Hawaii, and I guess everyone else was like, well, we want a tropical vacation too. So they went to Okinawa and said, oh, let's pick up on this kind of traditional, you know, the overall vibe and scenery of Okinawa, but also some of the indigenous culture there. So it's very steeped in a kind of Japanese culture, but not like what we tend to think of now as Japanese culture. Like, you know, as outsiders in America, we kind of have this, you know, sort of limited window into what Japanese culture means. But this is a sort of different corner of Japan, a different area of Japanese history and heritage. So, you know, it builds on that, and it's just this gorgeous looking game, not just in terms of visual resolution and art design, but in terms of color, in terms of like the deep blues of the water and just the overall sense of tropical vibes and the clothing and the building designs and everything. And of course, there are some places in the game that are much more traditional, like Final Fantasy Megalopolis, like where you go have to deal with Seymour. And of course, the temples that you have to like solve box puzzles, basically. They're all kind of like sci-fi futurism. But for the most part, Final Fantasy X's world is not more rustic, but just feels more naturalistic than what you had really seen in the recent Final Fantasy games. And, you know, it kind of has an overall vibe in terms of color and aesthetic that really kind of puts me in mind of Chrono Cross, which is a high watermark of PlayStation 1 visual design. So that's a good place to start from. And it just kind of took the Chrono Cross spirit and vibe and took it to the next level, brought it into full 3D of a sort. And so, you know, it's, you know, as a sort of half step into the future and into the new technology on the way to the fully immersive open world of Final Fantasy XII, it was a pretty convincing half step, I would say.
This was when Square still knew how to make cohesive worlds, which they would completely forget how to do starting with Final Fantasy XIII.
Yeah, the fact that like every, you know, all of the architecture and all of the locations in this were kind of, you know, had like actually had like a one inspiration that they were specifically drawing from gave it a cohesiveness that, yeah, may have been lost in later titles for sure.
And I also think this was co-developed in Hawaii, like Final Fantasy IX, so they just had to look out their window to see the beauty they could put on the screen that they weren't allowed to actually interface with because they were busy working on a game. And I think maybe part of my dislike of this game was it came out during a harsh northeastern Ohio winter, and I was resentful of these characters in this tropical setting.
You're like, fair enough. I wish I could wear a pair of pants that came down three quarters of my leg on one leg and one half of my leg on the other leg.
It was my first semester at college, and I was just walking across a tundra-like campus in the dead of winter.
Well, you know, ultimately, the important thing to remember is that this game was powered by the Emotion Engine and therefore had to bring emotion to Final Fantasy, although we kind of got that with Final Fantasy VIII. And in fact, you know, that is the one sort of, you know, besides like the spell effects and just the overall character design, I would say that's the thing that is most like, oh, yes, this is definitely cut from the Final Fantasy PS1 cloth, because we do have the love song. We do have like the scene where the main character and his love interest are like floating around being all dewy eyed at each other. So they did have that.
You know, there's obviously this the design of this game took some cuts to the scope that we would typically like, or the, you know, certainly the grandness of, say, the PlayStation 1 Final Fantasy games. But it does seem to me in retrospect that the cuts they made were the correct ones, because I think they understood that the game development was going to get more challenging. You know, doing these higher resolution assets was going to be more time consuming. And so I feel like the the areas that they did cut, you know, they made it more linear. They narrowed the story down to sort of just focus on this sort of love story between Tidus and Yuna. They were actually pretty smart cuts. I mean, they were able to ship this game within a year of the PlayStation 2 launching. You know, I mean, that was it seems like they did a good job in that respect. Other decisions that they made may have been more questionable, but in terms of just like, and again, like as we said, that the diorama like sets, it wasn't truly fully a 3D world to run around in. Those all seem to me to have been pretty pragmatic choices that allowed them to get this game out there, and I think to really concentrate on what was going to feel the most next gen, right? I mean, they could have made a fully 3D world, but then it might not have looked as, you know, immediately gorgeous when you looked at it. And the fact that this game was the first Final Fantasy to have not voice acting all the way throughout, but a great deal of voice acting was, you know, if they'd created like a huge sprawling game, then the voice acting wouldn't have been as easy to, but sure, it was very difficult to pull off, but it wouldn't have been as easy to pull off because, you know, you wouldn't have had this linear story that they could follow along with.
Yeah, I feel like you mentioned the story is much more narrow, and going back over it in preparation for this episode, I was actually kind of struck by how straightforward the actual story is. The plot is a bit, you know, kind of the backstory and the usual daddy issue stuff. Like, that's all a bit convoluted, but the actual story, you know, of getting from one point to the other to beating the final boss is much more narrow than you usually have in a Final Fantasy game. They're not traveling all over the world and kind of following these thin leads. It is very much a story that is driven by one character's quest, and that is not the main character. The main character is kind of along for the ride, even though the game begins by saying, listen to my story. It's not really Tidus's story. It's really Yuna's story, and he's kind of the point of view character for it. And I think it actually is stronger for that because it is more focused. There is a sense of purpose that you tend not to get in the other Final Fantasy games. They all seem to have kind of this driving focus for a while, and then something happens and you're like, well, now it's all kind of abstract and, you know, like, Kefka blew up the world and now I just have to kind of wander around in the wasteland, or, well, I left Midgar, now what do I do? Or, wow, my school can fly. Amazing. where the hell am I going? This never has that moment. I mean, there are definitely some parts where the main quest line gets interrupted, and of course it all kind of falls apart in the end once the reality of what the quest is even about is kind of revealed to the characters. But I would say it really holds its focus and has a center much more so than maybe any other Final Fantasy game. And I think that's actually one of its strengths. I mean, it does maybe make the game feel a little smaller, but you know, I don't think it's bad for a game to be small. It doesn't have to necessarily span the entire world and take you all over the planet to give you a sense that, hey, this is a big tale. This is epic. This like affects all life on the planet. You know, everyone that I know, everything that I care about, everyone who lives is affected by the actions in this story. I mean, it's still, you know, it definitely still has that sense of scale to it, even though it does take place in a much smaller physical area, more contained physical space.
Yeah, it has more appeal to me now.
Yeah, I agree with Jeremy.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Kat.
Yeah, I agree with Jeremy. I just replayed Final Fantasy VIII, actually, and the thing that stood out to me was that the way that it was kind of treated like an anime, and that it had a lot of very small story arc or episodic moments that were contained within the broader story, and then each disc kind of functioned as a season finale. Whereas Final Fantasy X manages to keep the focus a lot more on what the overall goal of the story is. And as a result, it doesn't feel quite as disjointed, or there are moments where you're like, where is this going? Like, why am I in Timber, etc. So in that respect, I think I do agree with you, Jeremy.
Yeah, my needs have definitely changed in terms of RPGs, because I just want games to be much smaller now, and they never are. And at the time, I had youthful energy. I was 19. I had a part-time job and no girlfriend. All I wanted was a 100-hour world-spanning quest. But now this feels like a much more appealing experience to me.
Well, that's why they were also making Final Fantasy XI at the time, Bob, so that you could have, you know, not just 100 hours, but the thousands of hours. Mm. We'll cover Final Fantasy XI at some point, but we're going to have to get people on the show like
James Milkey
or Alex Fraioli, who have actually committed, you know, years of their life to this game, because I can't even begin to grasp the scale of that experience. It's just, you know, very, very different than what you have here, which is a pretty compact, contained game. I think you can finish it pretty easily in less than 50 hours. And if you want to do all the bonus stuff in the international versions, the HD remasters, that's going to be, you know, another probably 100 hours of grinding. But it's not really, you're not actually doing that much stuff. You're just, you know, speccing out your characters and building them up to completely ridiculous, arbitrary tasks. But that's really all there is to this game. But, you know, on the whole, I think I'm okay with that. I think it is a pretty strong game, in large part because of how finite it is. And, it does have that very specific sense of focus on its characters.
In terms of the story, one thing that I've always wished is that with Final Fantasy X, I had gotten Jack Braska and Orin's story instead of Tidus and Yuna's story, and that maybe Tidus and Yuna's story had been Final Fantasy X too. Because I think that, first of all, they were interesting characters in their own right. I enjoyed learning their story throughout the course of Final Fantasy X. And there's also a kind of a tragedy at the end where ultimately their quest is kind of a failure. They fall prey to the spiral, the loop of Spira, or whatever it is. But then ultimately their kids are able to complete the quest. And you could argue that Final Fantasy X has a more satisfying ending because they're able to break the cycle at the end of the day. But I don't know. I like a good tragic ending, right? And I liked Joran, Orin, and Jack and Braska more than I did most of the main cast of Final Fantasy X.
You know, that's the Final Fantasy VIII problem, where you get the flashbacks to Laguna and Kyros and Ward, and you're like, oh, these guys are great. Why do I have to be whiny Squall? Who cares about him?
I don't want to be Tidus.
Laguna. Yeah, exactly. So they were kind of, actually sort of, you know, reusing an idea that they had already previously used. Like, here's the story of the previous generation that you're seeing, and it's your time to figure out what your place in this cycle is. But at the same time, they made the mistake of like giving you little bits of these characters that make them seem much more appealing and enticing than the characters you're stuck playing as. And Tidus is definitely, he's kind of a tough character to deal with because he is so just childish. He's got that like, hey everyone, I'm Genki, hooray! But it's he's a tough pill to swallow sometimes.
Final Fantasy X would be better without Tidus. I'm just saying that.
I agree.
Should have been the main character all along. We didn't need him like being the guy on the outside looking in, and we didn't need the whole "is Xanakern real? Is Tidus real?" thing. Like, I think that if the story had kept its focus very squarely on Yuna and her journey and her breaking the cycle and giving her some agency in all of it, Final Fantasy X, like, I would have been really down for it. And instead, I don't know. I think Tidus made it a lot weaker. We didn't need his daddy issues.
Well, that's why you got Final Fantasy X-2, the game that doesn't have Tidus. And in fact, bringing Tidus back is just a ridiculous, convoluted process that requires strategy guides and tons of effort. So it's easier to just say, yeah, at the end of Final Fantasy X, Tidus ceases to exist and everything's better now. So, talking a little bit, we kind of touched on the creative team behind Final Fantasy X, but it is worth touching on a few of these people because there are some pretty big changes. Like I mentioned earlier, Hironobu Sakaguchi was not the producer on this game. He had been, you know, the director on the early, the designer on the early Final Fantasy games and moved to producer. But then at this point, he was like, I'm going to make movies and I'm going to be a superstar director. It's going to be amazing. This is going to be the future. Polymorphic content, hooray. And that did not work out. But in the meantime, Yoshinori Kitase, who had worked on Final Fantasy VI, VII, VIII, he stepped in as the producer and director for this game. So that was a pretty big task. I mean, it is really, in a lot of respects, his game. And that's probably why it kind of pulls so much from Final Fantasy VII and Final Fantasy VIII in terms of, you know, some of the story beats and the way it's structured. And I think he did a pretty good job here, you know, moving the series to new technology. Certainly, he navigated that a lot better than Square would with Final Fantasy XIII and its move to HD consoles. But I, you know, I think on the whole, this is a pretty good notch on his belt, you know, like a strong bullet point in his curriculum vitae.
I already mentioned that Final Fantasy X did not start out as a Final Fantasy game, so not extremely well known, but in Final Fantasy Ultimania Archive Volume 3, it apparently originally started as 1717, a game in which a character who looks kind of like Tidus, but not really, looks a little bit tougher, very muscly. He's seeking a cure for a raging pandemic that mysteriously kills people once they hit 17 years of age. And he's traveling the world seeking this cure, knowing that his own time is fast approaching.
Hmm.
And that's the numeral 17, and then the word 7, and then a space, and then the word teen.
But it has a subtitle, Angelic Impact Cross Devil Shock.
Again, this is...
So, I mean, perfectly rational Square Enix name, or Squaresoft name, I guess, at the time.
This is the Kingdom Heartsening of Final Fantasy.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, you can say with Final Fantasy VIII that Nomura was very much becoming the Nomura that we'd come to really start to know, right? Like, that was the beginning of the Kingdom Heartsening, but Final Fantasy X just hit the accelerator. And what's funny is that I played Kingdom Hearts and Final Fantasy X at basically the same time because I was borrowing them at the same time. And I remember playing it and thinking, I don't really like this. It doesn't feel quite right to me. And little did I know.
Yeah, Final Fantasy VIII was the beginning of the process where Nomura was like, well, guess what? I made up Cloud. I am king shit. I'm going to do whatever I want. And sometimes that's been interesting and sometimes it has not. But yes, Tetsuya Nomura, the lead character designer on Final Fantasy X. I don't know that he had any other real creative input in the game, though. Just, you know, like giving Lulu all the belts, like everyone's belt, just please. It's like she raided a Goodwill bin and just took all the belts and made a dress for herself.
You know,
maybe she doesn't have a lot of money, Jeremy.
That's fine. I'm saying, though, like, you can't raid the Goodwill bin. You've got to like share it, you know, you got to give to charity.
Maybe
you can't
there
just
was
steal
a sale.
Everything. Okay.
I'm happy you brought up Goodwill because I was going to a lot of anime conventions around this time and there were a lot of Lulus, and I swear the nearby Goodwills were just raided of belts. There was none available.
Also of note is the soundtrack was composed by Nobuo Uematsu, of course, but not just Uematsu. This was the first core Final Fantasy game where Uematsu did not do, you know, the bulk of the work all on himself. It was kind of a split between himself, Masashi Hamauzu, who previously had composed the Saga Frontier 2 soundtrack, and Junya Nakano, who I'm not familiar with their work, but you can definitely, like, when you sit down and listen to the soundtrack, you can definitely say, like, oh yeah, I recognize, like, this is definitely a, you know, Uematsu prog rock kind of thing. Oh, and then this is like kind of a lush symphonic piano and strings thing. That must be Hamauzu. And then this is more brassy and bombastic. I guess that's Nakano. But it does, you know, mean that the soundtrack has less of a consistent vibe and sound to it, even though it's using kind of the same instrumentation. Like, each of the composer's voices comes through, which is really interesting. But, you know, this would be kind of the end of Uematsu's I think just him realizing, like, I'm getting older and I'm being asked to churn out like 4 or 5 CDs worth of music every year or two, and I just can't keep doing this. It's crazy. I've got to slow it down and share the workload. And you know, it's good because it did open up the Final Fantasy series soundtracks to other composers. Hamauzu took the lead on Final Fantasy 13, and whatever you may think of 13, like, you can't deny that soundtrack is just spectacular. So, you know, it's continuing the tradition of great Final Fantasy music, but not just, you know, like, here's Uematsu and his love of prog rock. He's, you know, you got some Uriah Heep going while you save the world.
Yeah, we talked about it in the Final Fantasy IX podcast in that he was hitting his 40s, and in Final Fantasy IX, he wrote 160 songs for that game, and I think he realized his limits and realized, like, I'm now so senior, I can just kind of oversee things. And that's what we see a lot of these people who wrote this much music in this era do, like Mitsuda, they later become overseers and contribute some tracks, but they're not writing these massive soundtracks anymore.
Mm-hmm. I thought that while To Xanargand is a really nice theme, and I remember sitting in our student union and listening to somebody playing that on the piano and thinking how nice that is. And there's some nice tracks for when Tidus and company are on the road, really kind of captures that sort of chill vibe as you're moving toward your destination. But otherwise, I find Final Fantasy X's soundtrack to be a little bit uneven. I'm not the biggest fan of its nominal battle theme. And so when I think of Final Fantasy's best soundtracks, Final Fantasy X doesn't usually jump to mind outside of maybe To Xanargand.
I don't know. The battle theme has that kind of this is your, you know, your newscast at 6 vibe, the best Final Fantasy soundtrack battle themes do.
Action sports.
But, that's right. Yeah, one of the things I really appreciate about this is that by opening this up to voices besides Uematsu's, you do have some textures and some tones that you wouldn't expect in Final Fantasy that I think at times really complement the scene, even if they don't necessarily work as well in isolation. Like, the way the story is structured, there's this introductory sequence that takes place in the futuristic Panopolis of Xanargand, and it seems like, you know, it's going to be another sort of Final Fantasy VII kind of thing, you know, a futuristic vibe to it. And then all of a sudden that comes to an end. Like, you're pulled out of Xanargand and dropped into these sunken ruins. And, you know, it's just like that kind of sets the tone for, hey, everything's going to be different than what the lead-in led you to expect. But the music, like the theme in that, those ruins, when you're kind of out of sorts and like, what the hell happened? You know, why do I have to swim around now? Who are these people who are speaking a weird language? The music there is more atmospheric and more ambient than than anything that had appeared in a previous Final Fantasy game. And you do have it kind of connecting with the overall, I guess, trend of film music, you know, that we saw after the 90s, where things became a lot more atmospheric, a lot more, you know, kind of electronic and driven by drum machines and things like that. This does embrace a lot of kind of big musical trends. And, you know, at the same time, we had Metal Gear Solid 2, which also embraced a lot of those. But they actually hired a Hollywood film composer, Harry Gregson-Williams, and were like, hey, you know, make this on point and trendy with Hollywood. And Final Fantasy X kind of does that on its own without necessarily pulling in Hollywood help. It's more like, here's, you know, cinematic trends, Hollywood trends, as interpreted by, you know, this team in Japan or Hawaii, as the case may be. And so it does give it a little more of a, I think, distinct flavor. But at the same time, it is different than Final Fantasy 1 through 9, basically, the sound of those games. And I think does help kind of in a sort of subtle way that you don't necessarily think about consciously as you're playing, but it's always there with you, really helps kind of drive home the idea that this is a different kind of Final Fantasy and the series was going in different directions. And so I think, you know, in that respect, the soundtrack really works.
It's another, you know, it's another kind of like indication that looking back, this was kind of the, I don't want to say beginning of the end, but it was the sort of pivot point where the Final Fantasy series went from, you know, maintaining that same idea of the games are supervised by Sakaguchi and they're, you know, the character designs are by Amano and the, or, you know, because, the, or certainly like the Yoshitaka Amano, like illustrations and style are really adhered to, and the music is entirely by Uematsu, and it wasn't a clean break, but you could start to see, okay, well, Uematsu is giving up some control over the music, and, you know, Nomura is becoming, you know, more prominent in terms of the character designs that are being featured. And it's a new crew of people, but they're still kind of sticking to a lot of the trends or the themes of the early Final Fantasy games, but they're getting ready to kind of abandon all of that, you know, for better or worse.
Then on the writing front, I think we have an even bigger collaboration. It's Kitase, as well as Kazushige Nojima, who wrote the story for Final Fantasy VII, but Tomu Toriyama, who wrote a lot of the dialogue and text for Final Fantasy VII, and Daisuke Watanabe. I'm not sure what they did. I did not see a big, you know, list of their previous work, but it was nothing with Final Fantasy before that. But, you know, you have four people writing this game, and I think all of them were kind of really into that, like, post-Evangelion, everything's got to be just a total mind screw. You got to just make it super complicated. You got to have a big twist. And I think that is definitely the biggest weakness in Final Fantasy X. I don't know. I suppose everyone has their own opinions about where the game stumbles. But for me, it's just there's all this convolution around Xanarkand and the nature of Tidus and so on and so forth. And it just feels like they were trying a little too hard. Did Sin really have to be Tidus's dad? I mean, I guess maybe that works because there is that cycle thing. But then did, you know, Tidus and Auron have to be imaginary characters? Sorry for the spoilers, you know, like they didn't really exist. They were dreams. Like,
and everybody's secretly a zombie too.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody, just some of the people
up front. You mentioned the Sixth Sense, the movie, and that's a great comparison, but I think that was a direct inspiration because that was a huge movie and that was a cool idea that most of us had not seen pulled off that well, and this is a very similar plot twist.
I feel like that is where the game kind of trips up, and it just feels like it's convoluted for the sake of being convoluted. And I don't know that Final Fantasy has ever quite outgrown that. I feel like Final Fantasy 13 didn't really have the big twists like that necessarily, but it was just it did not present its world very well, and it's full of jargon and concepts that are just not they're poorly explained. So that's something I would really like to see the Final Fantasy franchise really work to improve in the future. And then finally, the last significant kind of creative team elements that I want to talk about are the designers. And there are actually three facets to the design handled by Motomo Toriyama, Toshiro Tsuchida, and Takayoshi Nakazato. And each of them handled a different part. For me, the most important of these, the most significant, is Tsuchida, who had previously worked on Front Mission 3, and he was assigned the role of battle director. And this is one of the big places where Final Fantasy X breaks from the previous Final Fantasy games. The prior six Final Fantasies had all worked around the active time battle system concept, you know, that was come up with for Final Fantasy IV. It basically take turn-based combat, add this partially real-time element to it, inspired by, you know, the way cars lap each other on a racetrack. And that was gone. There was no element of real-time battle in Final Fantasy X. It is strictly turn-based, and your dudes will stand there, you know, just bobbing up and down, waiting politely to take a turn for as long as you want to sit your controller down. And you don't have to worry about, you know, jumping in or queuing up commands or anything like that. It is called the conditional turn-based battle system because, of course, it is. but it totally changes the nature of battle. It's much more akin to what we saw in Final Fantasy Tactics or in Front Mission. And I've read that Tsuchida was specifically brought in to bring a different flavor to Final Fantasy combat, and so he looked more to his work on, you know, a tactical game, and said, "Let's bring this into a smaller scale, three on however many enemy characters kind of combat situation and see where that goes."
It's actually one of my favorite Final Fantasy battle systems because I always really enjoyed how it was able to incorporate the entirety of the team. And I'm going to refer back to Final Fantasy VIII again, because, again, that was the game I just replayed. Final Fantasy VIII really wanted you to use all of the characters. And so it was trying to find ways to have different permutations of the characters, like when you go to the Galbanian missile base and all of that. But in Final Fantasy X, you could just swap them up in as necessary. And so it really gave you a sense that there was a full party that was moving toward the destination, and encouraged you to experiment a lot more with the characters that you wouldn't normally use, like, say, I don't know, Waka. And then beyond that, I really enjoyed, while it made the summons kind of overpowered because they could easily absorb attacks and you could just bring them in anytime to do like some serious damage, it also made the summons feel very powerful and like agents in their own way versus, say, Final Fantasy VIII, where you just summon them and then they appear and they do their cool attack and then they're gone. In Final Fantasy VIII,
you smash buttons. You smash buttons.
Yeah. In Final Fantasy X, for example, when you get to Unalaska and you're like, okay, time to send out my summons because she's about to use level 5 death on my whole party. And if I'm at the wrong level, I'm going to have to rewatch that entire cutscene that takes like 45 minutes to get through. God. So, I like Final Fantasy X's battle system a lot. It feels a little slow. Did the remastered versions have a times 3 speed, or is it just at a normal speed?
I don't think it didn't have it. I've been playing that on Switch, and there's no like button that you can press to speed things up. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it really needs a times 3 because, holy gosh, that game is kind of slow.
So I agree totally. Like, I really like this battle system. It's the fact that I think it's so important that you can swap in characters at any point with no penalty for doing so. Right. I mean, that just makes it. If there was any kind of penalty for swapping in players, people wouldn't do it. And so I think that I love the idea that you get to think about the whole party all the time. Who are the three best people to have out right now? And the fact that, oh, somebody needs to be cured. I don't have Yuna in here. Well, let me just get her in for anybody, and I can do that.
I think.
And
I was going to say,
pleasant.
I like it more in boss battles than I do in normal encounters, because often you just want to get to the end of a normal encounter. You don't have to say, okay, time to bring out Waka because this enemy's flying. Time to bring out this guy because this enemy's weak against that. I just, often it does add a tiny bit more tedium to the fights, but I do like the flexibility ultimately.
I actually found it to be the opposite. I feel like it actually helps me speed through those standard encounters. You know, if you're not strong enough yet, if you're not leveled up enough yet that you can just plow through everything in a single hit, then being able to bring in a character with, you know, basically the press of a couple of buttons who can steamroll the enemies, you know, like Riku is a great example. Her thieving skills, her mug abilities, like those are really, really effective against mechanical enemies. And she can basically one-shot pretty much any kind of robot. And so being able to bring her in to just clear out the enemy field almost instantly, as opposed to having to slug through and be like, oh, I'm gonna wait for my my thunder magic to cast, but I don't want to use my magic points, this sucks, you know, just being able to bring her in and let her do her thing is great. So I really like this battle system a lot.
One thing I want to add
I think it was really controversial at the time, though. Go ahead, Bob.
One thing I want to add is because of the boost in technology, it is a lot faster because you don't have to wait 15 to 20 seconds for everything to load into the arena and for the camera to stop spinning around everyone.
Yeah, it does load it more quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think it was a matter of basically like loading one game technology platform in and then replacing it with another. I think they were, you know, kind of using like the same framework, if that makes sense, the same basic engine and just different variants on it, as opposed to the PlayStation 1 games where it's like, here is a 2D screen with some 3D elements. Now we are going all to 3D for combat. I just feel like that took a lot more.
Yeah.
Required a lot more swapping of components. Maybe I'm stupid and have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes to technology. That's entirely possible. But yeah, I do agree that the combat system feels a lot zippier. The random encounters, although still not my favorite thing, like they're much less onerous here than in Final Fantasy VIII or IX, where, you know, the loading time for a battle could be like 15 seconds long. Just so, so tiresome.
And even the music,
here it's much zippier.
The music just starts too. There's no build up to the fight. It because the music is reflecting the technology is faster too. So it just starts and you're just in the battle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but there are a lot of great innovations in this combat system. I mean, everyone has kind of touched on swapping characters with no penalty, which is brilliant because, you know, it's different than in previous Final Fantasy games or really any other RPG I can think of. It almost makes me think of Vagrant Story, where you have, you know, different weapons that you've kind of cultivated to work against specific types of enemies, and you can jump into the menu and bring up that weapon and switch over to it with no penalty. But again, you know, that game was like the definition of loading times. So here it feels quick and really, really just peppy and energetic. It's great. But the other thing that I think really, really lends a lot to this game is the fact that turn order is displayed. There's no more wondering, like, how long do I have before this batch of enemies, you know, casts their super attack and just ruins my day. Like, there's no uncertainty about that. It's fully transparent. The entire battle order for like 12 turns, I can't remember exactly how many it is, but they're all shown out through little icons on the screen. And you look at those little thumbnails and you can say, well, like, two of my people get a turn, and then it's like four enemy turns. So, you know, one of the enemies in there has, you know, some sort of special weakness or something where I can disrupt, and that's going to give me a little bit of an advantage. And, you know, that's something that already existed in previous Final Fantasy games, but here it's much more explicit because that information is just presented in very plain, understandable, in a plain, understandable way, and would be pretty widely imitated. Like, the Shadow Hearts series immediately said, oh, that's really good, let's also do this. And you started to see this concept pop up more and more. And, you know, I do like the active time battle system. I like real-time combat. But there is something to be said for this sort of turn-based combat. I would say it kind of lives on with, like, Octopath Traveler and Bravely Default now, where, you know, you can sit back, take your time, really look at what's coming up next in the lineup, and tailor your actions around that, and, you know, say, well, you know, these enemies are all really fast, so I need to bring in someone who's going to be able to kind of counter that by having a high agility or you know, whatever. It just makes combat so transparent and gives you so much command over it. For the same reason, I think Saga Scarlet Grace is by far the best of the Saga games, just because it actually makes combat transparent. You have a clue what the hell is happening in battle, and that makes such a big difference. You're like, oh, Saga is actually a pretty good idea now that I understand it, now that the game does not hide every possible bit of information from me. It's all right here. So I would say this, the legacy of this game, if it were only the fact that it helped introduce the idea of combat transparency and just presenting players with necessary information, that's a phenomenal legacy. It makes games so much better.
One of the things that I really like about Final Fantasy X's battle system is, if you compare it to, say, Final Fantasy VII and VIII, a lot of the characters are kind of, you know, they're fairly dissimilar except for their limit breaks, and then you just attach builds to them. Whereas in Final Fantasy X, there's still that flexibility, but it feels like with special abilities, like you were just referencing with Riku's thieving abilities and her ability to destroy machines and everything, feels like every single character has a much more specific role. And so they aren't quite as generic as before. And so I think in their own way, that also helps their characterization, because you feel like you have a much more solid grasp of who all these characters are and how they fit into the overall party as they make their journey.
Okay, so I think we're all mostly positive on the battle system. But where do we stand on the sphere grid? First, would someone like to explain the sphere grid and then explain why it is good and or bad? I have my own opinions on it, but I'm curious to hear other people's take.
Okay, the sphere grid. Instead, you do not gain experience from battling, and your character's stats do not automatically increase. Instead, you gain AP, which is always something different in every Final Fantasy game. But at this, in this case, you use the AP not even to upgrade yourself.
That's ability points, right?
Sure, probably. the ability points.
They're awesome points.
Associated press.
Who can say? Who can say? Yeah, exactly. Points. Right. You use the AP simply to move about your character's sphere grid. Now, the sphere grid is a whole giant... I don't even know what you would call it, just mass of these sort of nodes that are connected by lines. And there's just one sphere grid, and every character starts out in a different place on that sphere grid. And so they start out on a node, and then that's connected via lines to other nodes. And the AP that you collect, all it does is it allows you to move about the sphere grid. And as you move about it, when you land on different nodes, you can then place a sphere, which you collect. You can find them in chests. You get a lot of them when you fight battles. There are abilities that will kind of allow you to use them on enemies during battle, to up the odds that the enemy will drop certain types of spheres. Then you use the sphere to activate those nodes on the grid. Some of those nodes are specific things where it's like, you know, you're Tidus and you're moving along your sphere grid, and then you get to a node that says H, and you use a power sphere on that, and you get Tidus gets more hit points. If you move along and there might be an ability that Tidus can unlock if you use an ability sphere on that one. And then some of the nodes are empty, then you can use other spheres to transform the empty nodes into types of nodes. Like if you use a magic sphere or I think an MP sphere on an empty node, it will then become a space that you can then use. You can then use a monosphere on that space to give yourself more MP. So there's two kind of ways to do it. And you sort of every now and again, as you gain sphere levels and more spheres, you want to dip into that menu. And that's how you advance your characters. There are multiple pathways that a character could take on the sphere grid, but in general, those are locked off, and you have to collect lock spheres to unlock those pathways, and then you can backtrack and go up those pathways. So basically, when the game starts off, you're pretty much you're going to be on one pathway with your characters, unlocking certain upgrades and stats for them. But as you start to collect some lock spheres, then you can kind of look and say, oh, okay, well, there's multiple pathways that I could backtrack to on this grid, but I could only unlock a few of them because lock spheres are kind of hard to come by. So, I mean, I have to kind of make a decision as to where I'm going to go. Now, if you want to go crazy, as I think you were saying, Jeremy, you know, towards the end of the game, and you want to just like get every, you know, thing on the grid with everybody, it's probably possible. But what's probably going to happen is you're going to sort of, you know, just occupy a portion of the sphere grid with each character. And so that's pretty much it. I am kind of torn. I think it's interesting, but it also feels like a whole bunch of busy work that I have to do.
Yeah.
While they could just, it's like, why don't you just give Tidus 200 more hit points instead of making me go into a menu every couple of minutes and upgrade my characters that way?
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I also think that there's the international version of this sphere grid. And I think that is really designed for people who have played the game before, because it gives you an almost overwhelming amount of choices to make. And you can kind of screw yourself, not into a fail state, but in a less than ideal way to build your characters. I do think that the version as it exists in the original game is the ideal version. There's the version that would later pop up in Final Fantasy 13, which is sort of like, pull the button in and you'll get the stat boost he would have given you anyways. And then there is the international version on the other end, which was just maybe too many choices up front, too many pathways up front. And I feel like the original system is the happy medium between those two ideas.
Yeah, I'm not really deeply in love with the Sphere Grid. I feel like it's, you know, kind of as everyone has said, it's kind of making you do the legwork to do something that any other game would just, you know, make an automated process. But also, I just feel like it's basically saying, hey, every character has their specialty. You're going to develop a character pretty much the same way most of the time. And then giving you a little bit of an option to branch out from time to time, more so at the end. You know, you can teleport into someone else's area of the grid, like to where that person is on the grid, using a very hard to come by teleport sphere. But, you know, by and large, it just kind of feels like, why would you necessarily want to do that unless you've really mapped out how this is going to work for you? I mean, you can find facts online that will give you these optimized builds, but it's very specific in saying, like, you definitely want to get these things with this character, because if you get these other things, they kind of suck at it. Like, you don't want to turn Lulu into a healer because her magic stat is actually bad. What you want to do is turn Yuna into a mage, and then you never have to use Lulu again.
Yeah,
and
that's I definitely like ran into that, because at one point, I remember in my first playthrough, I got really excited because I stole from a boss and I stole a 3-level lock sphere. And I was like, oh my goodness, I can, you know, that means I can go into the sphere grid and I can take, you know, it ended up being Riku and I can get Ultima. I don't know if it was Ultima, but it was something where it's just like I was able to get, you know, a really, really powerful magic spell, you know, behind this level 3 lock because I thought ahead and stole from this one, you know, missable enemy, and I got her this magic spell and it didn't do a damn thing because she wasn't actually very powerful at magic. And so it's like, what the hell was the point of that?
Yep.
Yuna is really overpowered in general because she encompasses a white mage, she is a summoner, she can use holy, and if you get black magic on her, she's really good at that as well. And so she's kind of your all-in-one character that you should probably never, ever have out of the party.
Yeah, and on the flip side of that, I would say Kimari is a great indication of the weakness of the Sphere Grid, because he's the one character who doesn't have an innate specialty. He's the blue mage. You kind of get him later than everyone else, and he doesn't have his own specific area of the Sphere Grid. Like, he starts in a specific spot, but there's only like two skills that are unique to him. And then everything else is basically like, well, where do you want to go, Kimari? Whose path do you want to follow? And you can follow any of them. But the thing is, Kimari's not really as good at any of those characters as, you know, like whatever path he follows, he's not going to be as good at it as the character who is designed to go down that path. So he's kind of this superfluous character who doesn't really have that much role in combat that I could at least determine for myself. He's just kind of like showing you the worst sort of failing of the Sphere Grid. So, you know, as an object lesson, I guess he's good, but as a character, as a combatant, maybe not so much.
Nobody likes Kimari.
Even other Ronso don't like Kimari.
As advancement systems or progression systems go, I don't think the Sphere Grid is maybe as good as some of the other systems, but at the same time, it's still better than sort of what came afterward, because it does provide at least a degree of flexibility, and there's a certain kind of soothing aspect that appeals to completionists. I have a friend who, when she was playing Final Fantasy X, she just got really invested in the idea of completing every single sphere in that particular grid, and that made her very happy. And I've heard of people who are like that. So there's something about putting those little spheres in those little holes that tap into a certain part of the brain for a certain kind of person.
It's like a checklist.
Yeah, I mean, the Sphere Grid is basically like the Candy Crush Saga map. So yeah, I can see why people get hooked on it.
Thank you.
I did want to bring up the localization really quick because you mentioned it up front, Jeremy, and one of the last things I wrote for the Games Press was this feature called True Tales from Localization Hell. I talked to a lot of localizers for some pretty big games, and one of them was Alexander O. Smith, who did the localization for this game with some other people, of course, and this was a controversial Final Fantasy game because it was the first one with voice acting, and the challenge that he and his team had was the fact that Square, when programming this game, did not account for English dubbing. I'm sure they knew it would happen, but they didn't necessarily care or have the time to figure out how it would work on the English dubbing end. So the scripting language for this game, it is written in a way in which lines have to be a certain amount of frames long, spoken lines of dialogue. If they go beyond that, then it messes with the scripting and everything goes out the window and the game crashes. So Alexander O. Smith and his team had to match the exact length of every Japanese line, playing with every sound clip as much as possible to get them to fit within those constraints. And he was pointing out in his interview with me that something as simple as saying yes in Japan, you're saying hi, and that is significantly fewer frames than saying yes. So he had to figure out a lot of different ways to extend pieces of dialogue, shorten pieces of dialogue, add things like character saying you know two sentences to either make them longer or give them more things to say. And I think he did a good job given his constraints, but you can tell that this is a very awkward localization because of that in terms of voice acting.
Yeah, people like to bag on the laughing scene, but that's probably the one that's most like in the spirit of the original Japanese in a lot of senses. You know, there's a lot of controversy over the fact that Yuna's final line to Titus is in English, I love you, whereas in Japanese, she just says arigato. But that's kind of like those two terms have the same cadence. They both end with her mouth, you know, forming an O, basically. So, or, you know, like a kind of a round vowel. And, you know, that had to match up with the lip flaps. So, you know, given the constraints and the just sheer technical nonsense involved in the system, which, you know, they were originally told that the Japanese version was not going to have you know, matched up lip flaps, so they wrote a script around the idea of just, you know, kind of generic mouth movements. And then once the game came in, you know, and the Japanese version came out and they were kind of given this more advanced version of it, all of a sudden they discovered, wow, these have synced up lip flaps, and they've actually, you know, animated the characters so what they're saying reflects, you know, is reflected in the movement of their mouth. So they had to rework their entire script in a matter of weeks. Like, it was, you know, and then the game was pushed forward several weeks, so that truncated even more time off the schedule. So the fact that it worked out as well as it did, I think, is kind of a miracle. It also, I think, speaks to, you know, one, Smith's sort of skill as a translator, and the high quality of the talent that Squaresoft had at this point, you know, for voice direction, but also the experience of the voice cast itself. I mean, if you look at the people who were doing voices here, like, they had been, you know, either in television shows or movies or just doing, you know, voice acting for years and years. It was a very seasoned cast. I mean, you have people like Tara Strong as Riku. She was in, you know, everything from the Super Mario show to various Batman series, to Powerpuff Girls. And you have, you know, James Arnold Taylor, who did voice acting in Monkey Island 2 and in Disney's Atlantis, which was kind of out at around the same time as Final Fantasy X. So he's now kind of better known, I think, as the voice of Obi-Wan Kenobi in the Star Wars cartoons. Hmm. But you have John DiMaggio of Futurama, you know, playing both Kimari, the lovable rascal, and Waka. So, yeah, a really, really talented lineup of people, but, you know, mostly kind of focused on the voice acting aspect, like people drawn in for their, you know, their kind of the quality of their voice and their experience just doing overdubs, as opposed to the more contemporary approach, which is like, here's Nolan North and a bunch of Hollywood people.
Yeah. And I also want to know what everyone thinks of the laughing scene, because when I was talking to Alexander O. Smith, when he was given that, he was like, what the hell is this? What do I do with it? But apparently, Nojima, one of the writers on the game, had been taking drama classes, and that was one of their exercises, is the fake laughter to get you into a mood to act in a scene. It was sort of just like a kind of like a stretching exercise almost for acting. And that is exactly what he translated it to. And I've seen people try to justify the scene and try to make it seem redeemable, but in my eyes it makes Tidus look like an absolute psycho. And now that I look at it, you know, knowing a lot more about the world, there's something kind of creepy about a man saying to a woman, you should smile more.
I hate this scene. I mean, at the time, I remember the first time I saw that scene and actively cringing at it, and I just don't think you can get past the cringe factor. You can like explain it away and talk about all the ways there's like, no, Tidus is trying to lighten the mood and get Yuna to get out of her own head or whatever, but I don't like it. I think everybody always kind of reacts in the same way when they've seen that scene for the first time, which is to look over their shoulder and say, is anybody in here in the room with me? Because I feel embarrassed.
Yeah.
Just to be watching this.
Kat, it's funny you mentioned that, because when that happened, I thought to myself, should I play this game with my bedroom door closed? Because I was still living at home.
And that's the core of it, is that, so with Final Fantasy X, I think the voice acting actively hurts the storytelling, because when I'm playing Final Fantasy VIII, I think that they do a lot of interesting things with the text, and like having the little asides with the voice bubbles, and you can kind of imagine, you can kind of put yourself more into the characters. And when they start talking and everything, then you start automatically comparing it to movies. And Final Fantasy X at this time, it's just not going to match up to kind of the more mature medium of movies. And so as a result, like Final Fantasy X is always going to feel a little bit lesser, even if that's not necessarily fair in my mind.
Mm-hmm. I don't hate the laughing scene. I think it is like, I get what the idea there was. I don't think it's done well, but I do at least see what they were going for. But I don't know, like this game came out after Metal Gear Solid 2. And if you want to talk about cringy dialogue, that game is just like cringe from start to beginning. Just like, well, I'm dying, so let me tell you about the terrible thing that I did where I blew up a church. It's just like, compared to that, it's just, you know, video games of this era just weren't quite there when it came to writing and voice acting and presentation. That would come in time, but this was very definitely, you know, still kind of the teenage awkward years. Like, you know, yeah. Video games had hit puberty, but, you know, the voice was still cracking.
You're right. Holiday 2001 was the season of cringe for video game voice acting.
Oh, man. Yeah. But I will say, actually, before I say anything else, Chris, do you want to chime in?
On the subject of the laughing scene?
Or just voice acting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this was just, you know, awkward growing pains of the video games as a medium, of realizing that, oh, we're going to have voice acting, so let's hire these people who are, you know, well-known professional voice actors. But if you don't give them the support that they need, it's still actually going to turn out pretty bad, if they have bad direction, or in this case, if there's like severe technical limitations that the team did not think about, and as far as localization, et cetera, et cetera.
I will say that the one place where voice really, really does a lot for this game is not in the acting, but in the final boss theme, Under or Over Otherworld.
It's the worst
That's
boss
called.
Theme
no,
ever.
It's so good. It's so ridiculous.
It's so 2002. My
yes,
God.
Exactly.
It dates
God,
the game so
it
badly.
It is amazing. Like the way you have this, like, like the battle scene itself almost looks like stop motion. There's the avatar of Sin or whatever you're fighting, like Jekt himself. And then the weird things, like the columns that are next to him just kind of rotating randomly. It just feels so bizarre and just so incredibly, like, it is, you know, kind of like this other world that you're in. Like, I don't know, the grindy, horrible, screamoid music. I really genuinely unironically love it. It's not music I would ever listen to in any other situation, but in that one setting, that one boss fight, it's so on the mark. It's just phenomenal.
I wish I could be there with you,
but
Jeremy.
Apparently I'm in the minority there.
I wish I could be there with you, Jeremy, but it does remind me of one of the worst times in modern history to be alive outside of 2020, and that was immediately after 9/11.
See, I wasn't listening to popular music because that's not what I listen to.
I wasn't either. I was trying to avoid this shit.
Well, the trick is to just like live in your parents' basement or whatever I was doing.
I was in my bedroom, my childhood bedroom at age 19 playing this game.
Not sequestered enough. All right, fair enough. So apparently I am alone in thinking like this is just so bonkers, it's wonderful.
I do, Jeremy, I do like the Chocobo song from Final Fantasy 13-2, that nu metal Chocobo song, because it's a lot stupider. This song isn't stupid enough for me to like it.
Hmm. Okay, fair enough. I mean, it definitely has a Rob Zombie kind of thing going on, which, you know, like I said, normally this is not music I would ever listen to, but for that one battle, like the aesthetic of it is just like so, it's just so on point. And then, of course, you know, that's not the final battle. And once that's over, then it shifts to something that's much more uniquely Final Fantasy. And actually, the very final battle is really interesting because it's one you basically can't possibly lose. It's just kind of there for show, but you know, it feels very cathartic after going through all of that. And the final battle does have that interesting mechanic where, you know, because it's spoilers, the main character fighting his father, or like the soul of his father or whatever the hell, you can try to talk him down and you have dialogue prompts. And sometimes they'll be successful, but sometimes if you choose the wrong prompt, it'll actually piss off the boss and he'll attack even harder. So, you know, it really, really shows that fraught father-son relationship, you know, the daddy issue thing, just kind of like it is max daddy issue. We never needed another video game about father-son relationships after this. We got them anyway, by God, but this was the last one we needed.
I just love that Tidus's dad is apparently Captain Jack Sparrow 2 years before Pirates of the Caribbean came out.
You're right.
Well, he's much more likable than
Johnny Depp.
Wow, Johnny Depp. Yes. Wow. Yes. My brain very thoughtfully erased his existence, his name, from my mind. Great. Thank you, brain. I feel like I don't have a lot more to say about this game.
Wait, we don't want to throw a Blitzball?
Oh, we missed Blitzball entirely.
Okay, actually, this is where I was going. One thing that I will say is, you know, even though the game technology, like the sort of presentation is very constrained, very linear, very kind of like 3D diorama, one thing that they did take advantage of for this game, for this new tech, is to throw in a lot of different alternate modes and ideas and elements. Like, Chris, at the very beginning of the show, you said there's not really much in the way of side quests. And that's true in the sense of, like, you know, here is a thing that someone tells you about and you need to go do it. And, you know, there is a story that plays out through this. But there are a lot of other things you can do on the side. And, you know, even sort of the core story plays out through these puzzle dungeons where, you know, instead of fighting a big boss at the end of every temple, instead every temple is basically just like a time attack to push boxes and connect circuits, which, you know, I'm not sure how successful that is, but it is at least really different and shows them trying to like throw some other stuff in here. But then you also have Blitzball. So please, by all means, talk about Blitzball so I don't have to.
So the thing I love about Blitzball was I didn't even know anything about soccer at the time, but it turns out that I was a big fan of water soccer. And I always thought it was interesting that the developer seemingly played Captain Tsubasa for the old Famicom and went, you know what's a great idea? Let's take this game and just put it in a 3D water bubble. Because Captain Tsubasa was always a really interesting game in that it wasn't an arcade game per se. It was kind of a tactics game where you would try to maneuver your character up toward the goal, and then when you fired, it would do an RNG type thing where they would do a super attack, like the tiger shot, and then the keeper might be able to stop it. They might not be able to stop it. So it really spoke to where Japanese game development was at that time. And it feels like, I don't know if they've explicitly said it, but it feels like Blitzball is very much a tribute to that, in the way that you have your teams on each side and you're just trying to make your way toward the goal, and then you can do a tackle to try and stop them when you encounter an enemy. And if you can get past them, eventually you can take a shot on goal, and if the keeper is good enough, they'll make a stop, and if the keeper is not good enough, they will get scored upon. And of course, if you have Titus and you have the Jack shot, you can bounce the ball off like three different defenders and actually get a goal. And that's always the way to cheese the system. The Jack shot was so overpowered, but I just really enjoyed going around the whole world and basically asking everybody, do you want to be Blitzball? Want to play Blitzball? Want to play Blitzball? Just come join my Blitzball team. So you could call it water soccer. You could call it Quidditch, whatever. But it was a really enjoyable kind of arcade sequence. And the actual team building aspects were fairly addictive. And there were some really good rewards that came out of it. And it felt like the peak of this kind of era that came out of, you know, the Chocobo breeding or Triple Triad and all of that kind of thing. And after that, Square never really did anything to this level again in terms of its minigames. That makes me a little sad because Blitzball was great.
Hey, Kat, there's King's Knight.
Oh, right. What was that?
I forget. It isn't like Pachinko or
it's
something
in
like that.
Final Fantasy 15.
Right.
I didn't touch
Final
it.
Final Fantasy 15 game that became a mobile game as well, I think.
Well, it's based on an old NES game, but not really.
I wish they would have let you play that game.
And then they just put Triple Triad in Final Fantasy 14 because they're like, you know, it's great. Triple Triad. Let's just put it right in there. Next thing you need to put Blitzball in there.
Yeah, Final Fantasy 14 is really just about, like, let's do everything that Final Fantasy fans love.
Yeah,
let's
Chocobo
just give
Racing.
Them what they want.
Chocobo Racing's in Final Fantasy 14, and you're right, Kat, they should add Blitzball. I don't know why they haven't yet.
It's kind of an in-joke with my partner, where whenever I mention Final Fantasy 10, she'll just light up and go, want to play Blitzball? Because that's what I would say constantly when I was playing that game.
My favorite thing about Blitzball is that it was mostly optional, so my team lost that exhibition match that you're required to do in the story. That was it. I was done.
Well, it was kind of a confusing thing. It's like it has the mandatory Blitzball section where you're playing and you're going, this is really confusing and slow and I don't know what to do. And so I think a lot of people bounced off it, what was, I guess, supposed to be kind of a tutorial for the particular minigame. But once you kind of got to learn it, especially once you powered up Titus and again got the Jack shot, then it became a lot more fun. But you had to like really dig into it.
The way that it's introduced is just mind-bogglingly wrong. I mean, it's like because I just replayed this in the HD version, and it drops you into a menu-based tutorial where it's like, okay, now learn this whole sport via a barely interactive sort of menu, and it's like this massive list of all these things that it, now it's like game. Your game has been halted. You're this RPG you thought you were playing has now come to a crashing halt. Now there's a big menu in front of you. You as a player have no idea like how important is this gonna be. So as it turns out, you don't really need to learn how to play Blitzball. You can still beat the game and you don't actually have to play it, but like you don't really know that when you're faced with this tutorial. So now I'm like 30 minutes into going through all the menu options on this tutorial, and it's teaching me about every little aspect of Blitzball. That, you know, it's like you get down to the sort of like the doing the math of I'm going to pass the ball, but there's three defenders, but I want to break through this one defender. So then I'm going to subtract, you know, these numbers and whatever. And like you do all this stuff and you go through this whole tutorial. You're like, okay, I think I kind of vaguely understand. I guess I'll jump in here. Then you don't even play Blitzball after the tutorial because Yuna gets kidnapped and you go fight a boss. Like you go through this whole section fighting a boss, which is pretty cool. And then you come back and then you're thrown into a game. And by the time you're thrown, like literally in that span of time, I got thrown back into the game and it's like the game starts and it's like, wait, shit, what am I doing? And so like then the other team just starts wrecking me. I'm like, oh, wait. Okay. I have to do the math, whatever. So then I finally kind of get, and I forget, like, while the players are swimming around, you can press a button at any time to go into passing and shooting. But because it's like, okay, wait, which, because I don't know what button it is. It's like that was 17 tutorials ago that they told me what button to press to like stop the player to decide if you want to pass or shoot. So fortunately, I had like, it's like I admit you can get the jet shot, which is this really, really fantastic shot. that will actually power through an enemy's defense and really give you an excellent chance of scoring. But even that, you get it through a mini game that is terribly explained that I messed up the first time. I think when I played the game originally in Japanese, I blew that mini game and had no idea what had even happened, you know? And so I had actually reset the game and went back because I looked on an FAQ and I'm like, okay, now I see what you're supposed to do. Reset the game, went back, got the Jack shot. And like, it's just, oh man. I'm sure that it is a really interesting strategy game once you commit yourself to learning it. But boy, oh boy, oh boy, the way that it's introduced, I can't imagine, I can't think of how they could have done a worse job for the player. Like, introducing you to Blitzball and then giving you your first Blitzball experience in which the other team just like stomps all over you. Like, God, introduce it in a way that is compelling, tutorialize it in the middle of a game, let you win the game and get you like excited about Blitzball, give you a cool reward for doing it. Maybe the first few Blitzball matches that you can optionally do are like easy and you can win them instead of being like super complicated right off the bat, and like maybe you would have hooked more people into playing it, but instead it was just this like unless you're really committed, it's just a big turnoff.
And one of the big problems is that the Aurochs are just really weak, as you're already saying. So even if you already know how to play Blitzball and you have a pretty firm grasp of the rules, it's really, really hard to actually win. So when you're trying to figure out how to play the game and you're also playing with this really weak team, as you already said, Chris, it's no surprise that so many people are like, I don't get this. This is totally overwhelming. I never want to have to deal with this again. So it's too bad because the actual game itself is a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, you made me remember.
I will say it's better than the dodging lightning minigame.
That sucks. But yeah, the first time I played through this game or tried to play through the game, I stopped at Blitzball because it was such a frustrating and alienating experience. And Chris really underlined why.
Yeah, and the first quarter of Final Fantasy X in general is actually really slow. If I recall correctly, it's around this time that Final Fantasy X, at least in my recollection, starts to really pick up in terms of the pace in the story. So I can see why a lot of people would get to this point and be like, why am I playing this? This is like really slow and kind of boring, and I don't understand Blitzball. I'm out.
All right, so any additional thoughts on Final Fantasy X? We need to wrap this episode up to clear the decks for the next episode. But before we go, just where do you stand on this game, et cetera, et cetera?
You know, every time I talk about Final Fantasy X, I feel like I'm being really negative on it and I'm like pointing all of its flaws. And in a way, it's kind of like the opposite of Final Fantasy VIII in that way, where everybody was pointing out Final Fantasy VIII's flaws initially, but it seemed to have warmed up to it a lot over the years. Whereas Final Fantasy X, everybody was really warm on it to start, but over the years, it's kind of fallen in people's esteem, at least in North America. In Japan, it's still as popular as ever, maybe the most popular Final Fantasy. So this is what I'll say about Final Fantasy X. I think it's actually a really good game in many ways. I think that we talk a lot about its linearity, but you think about, there's a lot to explore about this world that I find really interesting. I really enjoy the process of finding the optional eons. I really enjoy playing Blitzball. I really enjoy the fact that you can learn the Elbed language over time. I thought that we didn't talk much about the Elbed in general, but the way that they were integrated into the story, that was one of the most compelling elements of that particular story to me. I, in general, like the cast a lot, except for Waka, who was racist.
He is racist. And,
oh, that's right. He is. Yeah.
I like the battle.
Riku, she's so great.
Yeah, I know. Riku's the best. And I really enjoy the battle system in general. And I think that it's kind of where Final Fantasy's battle system might have peaked in a lot of ways. Because after that, you know, they went much more into a real-time direction. They were obviously kind of embarrassed about the Final Fantasy kind of turn-based combat. So when I think about Final Fantasy X, I think of it as the end of an era, and it kind of fills me with a little bit of nostalgia. It was maybe the last truly great Final Fantasy. Sorry, Final Fantasy XII.
Hmm. I wanted to play through this before the podcast, but this month I've been playing Live Alive for another podcast, and that's also like a 40-hour game. But I think I might actually be more inspired now after our discussion, and I have bought it for like every platform because I'm stupid. So it's very available to me, and I think I might try to push past Blitzball this time and enjoy it.
Chris?
Yeah, I might. I mean, I was playing for this podcast. I'll probably keep going a little bit to continue to refresh my recollection on it because it has been 20 years. But yeah, I mean, it is a good game, and clearly it is. It really has some strengths. It will never be, I think, as good as it was when it was this incredible showcase of artistry combined with new technology that it was during that launch kind of window of the PlayStation 2.
Yeah, and I feel like in that way, Otherworld is a great, like, kind of the case in point example of what this game is about. It's very much about being in the year 2001. But yeah, like this game, like I said, I sank my life into it for a week and have never really felt super compelled to go back. And, you know, I've revisited it a few times on kind of with a light touch, you know, including for this episode, but have never really just felt like I need to go and live in that world again for 50 hours. Oh, I need to go beat the Dark Aeons and live in the world for another 400 or 500 hours. It's just, yeah, like it was a game that is part of the Final Fantasy series, and I love the combat system, but I feel like there are a lot of games that do that same kind of combat now. I, you know, mentioned some of them, like Octopath Traveler, and yeah, I don't know. Like it definitely had a lot of heart, and it also had a lot of like goofy narrative stuff, and just kind of uneven, like some tentative baby steps of Final Fantasy into the future. And, you know, in the sense that it's very uneven, I think it does represent the future of Final Fantasy, because the series has never been this kind of concrete unified front that it presented on Super NES and PlayStation. But you know, you take the good with the bad, and I still feel like this on the whole is a very good game, just one that you know, doesn't offer a lot of rewards for going back and spending time with it again, unless you just really, really love the love story of Tidus and Yuna. Yes, them. those people.
I like Eunice.
Eunice. I think Eunice was a villain in X-Men, so I don't know what's up with that.
I think a Square said, we're just doing Final Fantasy X again, but with a lot of quality of life improvements. I think a lot of people would be pretty happy, because I think a lot of people still look back pretty fondly on Final Fantasy X.
All right, so that wraps it up for this patron exclusive episode. So we don't need to tell you how you can find Retronauts, because you've already found us and you know how to support us. Thank you for finding us and supporting us. We appreciate your patronage, and hope that you enjoyed this episode along with all the other ones that we put out all the time. But, you know, if you would like to find the individuals responsible for this episode, well, that information is right here. Chris Kohler, where can we find you on the internet?
Well, you know, probably just Twitter would be a good place to start. Kobun Heat, KobunHeat is my Twitter handle. I am, well, so I can finally, I've been saying yes. So I'm currently editorial director at Digital Eclipse, making old video games new again. I can finally re-release the game.
Hooray.
I'm so excited. It's a Blizzard Arcade collection, collection of Blizzard games, The Lost Vikings, Rock and Roll Racing, and Blackthorn, which is now out on all major platforms with super, super cool definitive editions that we did that just blow my mind every time. Because
you guys did a 32X emulator for this, didn't you?
32X emulation for the Blackthorn 32X version. No idea. The definitive edition of Black. I still can't believe the team was able to do this, but like the definitive edition of Blackthorn has a Super Metroid style auto mapping feature now. Nice. And Rock and Roll Racing has 16:9. We have original CD quality audio, like the songs with vocals and everything for Rock and Roll Racing, like Highway Stars. It's I'm super, super jazzed to be a part of it. Then, of course, since I'm editorial director and in charge of writing and historical research and stuff like that, I mean, you know, work was on the museum, which has tons of stuff in it. And so, yeah, we did a game. So please enjoy it.
All right. And which of those were arcade games based on the title of the collection?
So Blizzard Arcade is what Blizzard calls its BlizzCon section every year, at which you can go to play its classic 16-bit games. So the title is a reference to the BlizzCon attraction.
There we go. Okay. And Kat, how about you?
My alternate joke when I came on this podcast was that I just wanted to hijack Retronauts and just say, but listen to my story. That's all you have to do in order to hijack a podcast. But anyway, hi, I'm Kat. You can find me on Twitter at @_Katbot. I'm also the host of an RPG podcast called Axe of Blood God. We talk about Final Fantasy quite a bit. We did a Final Fantasy ranking, a two-parter, where we ranked all of the mainline games. Final Fantasy X was in the top 10, so you should go listen to us talk about that game. We had a lot to say about it. Also, we have a Patreon. That's patreon.com/bloodgodpod. And if you listen to this, you're probably a Final Fantasy fan. Well, we just did Final Fantasy VIII for our monthly show, in which we determine if an RPG deserves to go into the pantheon of the Blood God. And Final Fantasy VIII was it. And you should go listen to that. It's a two-hour extravaganza where we just really break it down with Alex Donaldson from RPG Site. We had a great time.
And Bob.
Hey, everybody. It's me, Bob Mackey. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcasts are Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. Find those wherever you find podcasts or go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons for all kinds of bonus stuff. And if you're listening to this in late April, it seems, we are currently in the middle of our look at King of the Hill Season 2 on the Patreon. So if you want to hear us talk about King of the Hill, check it out at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, here doing stuff at Retronauts, on Twitter as GameSpite, at Limited Run Games, doing stuff like their newsletter, and also enormously huge projects that I should not have accepted the burden of, like the Monkey Island collection book, which is going to end up being like 240 pages long. It's ridiculous, but it's all a lot of fun. And, you know, like what Chris is doing, it's really cool to be involved in the republishing and preservation of classic games and actually, you know, have creative input into all of that. And there's some games that I've been working on that I've actually helped get licensed that we'll be announcing in the future. So that's what I'm doing when I'm not talking about old games. I'm actually bringing them to America and so forth. And also talking about old games on video on my YouTube channel, currently really focusing on the SG-1000 from Sega and the games that were released contemporarily for it on Nintendo's Famicom. It's a bunch of really old games, folks. That's kind of what I specialize in. Anyway, Final Fantasy X is also a really old game now. It's 20, so stick that in your pipe and feel sad about it. But we'll be back again in a few days with another episode and continue trucking along. So thanks again for your support. And until next time, remember to go into the sand and the dust in the sky. Go now. No better plan than to do or to die.